The air travel system here in the United States is, well, it's arguably the most complex logistical puzzle on the entire planet.
Oh, absolutely. High stakes is an understatement.
And for 43 days, during the longest government shutdown in U.S. history, that entire system was pushed right to the absolute breaking point. It was really just held together by, you know, dedication, mandatory overtime, and the sheer financial desperation of thousands of essential workers who weren't getting paid.
It was so much more than just an inconvenience for travelers. It wasn't just about delays. It really evolved into a systemic, and I think this is the key, unavoidable safety crisis.
Right.
By the time that political impasse finally broke in mid-November of 2025, the FAA, the Federal Aviation Administration, had already been forced to impose emergency flight restrictions.
Which had never happened before, not for this reason.
Never. I mean, we're talking about mandated flight cuts, not because of a hurricane or a blizzard, but because the staffing in air traffic control centers was just so critically thin that it was a genuine threat to public safety.
And that is the absolute core of our daily story brief today. We're going to trace that volatile, really dizzying journey of the National Airspace System, the NES, from a state of enforced chaos all the way back to stability.
And the timeline is so compressed. I mean, the shutdown officially ends on a Wednesday, November 12th.
Right.
But that aviation turmoil, those flight cuts that started a week earlier, they needed a whole multi-day phased recovery plan to wind down.
So normal didn't just snap back into place.
Not at all. Yeah. The official declaration that things were back to normal didn't happen until the start of the next week, Monday, November 17th.
So our goal here is to really get into the specifics, the data, the decisions, the consequences, and to analyze that incredible speed of the recovery once the money started flowing again.
And maybe more importantly, to look at the deep systemic vulnerabilities that this whole crisis just ripped the cover off of. Vulnerabilities that, frankly, are still challenging the system today.
Okay, so when we talk about this crisis, we have to start with the people. The entire thing was driven by the human cost of that shutdown. This wasn't a normal layoff scenario.
No, not at all.
It forced essential personnel, I mean, the highly skilled professionals, whose job is literally to keep planes from falling out of the sky, to keep working in one of the most stressful jobs imaginable, all while getting zero paychecks.
And with zero certainty about their future. Just imagine that.
And the scale is just staggering.
It is. You're talking about approximately 13,000 air traffic controllers. And then on top of that, another 50,000 TSA agents.
Wow.
These are people legally required to come to work because their job is deemed essential to national security. And yet, they missed two full paychecks during that 43-day period.
For a lot of them, especially the younger controllers who haven't built up savings, what does that mean in real dollars?
You're looking at, for some of them, maybe $8,000, $10,000 in lost income over just that short period. That's a mortgage payment, car payments, groceries.
That's devastating. Mm-hmm. And that financial reality just immediately starts to chip away at the integrity of the system.
Of course.
The ripple effects are visceral. We saw all those reports about the consequences for these workers who, like most Americans, are living paycheck to paycheck.
And it's not just some vague, oh, I'm stressed feeling. It translated into actions that directly compromised their ability to focus.
Right.
We had these widespread reports of controllers taking on second jobs just to get some cash flow, just to cover rent.
And the most cited example was driving for Uber or Lyft.
Yes. Can you imagine? You finish an 8-hour shift controlling the airspace over, say, Chicago, and then you jump in your car to drive strangers around until 2 a.m.
Knowing you have to be back on that console in just a few hours.
It's an impossible situation.
That level of fatigue, that kind of distraction, it's the absolute antithesis of what you need for safety in a control tower.
100%.
Yeah.
Managing high density air traffic requires total focus, zero distraction.
And when you're worried about whether your electric bill is going to get paid or if your kid's tuition check will bounce.
Yeah.
You're just not as effective.
And that's the direct link. Yeah. The financial stress becomes a safety hazard. It's not theoretical.
We saw controllers calling out sick at higher rates.
Mm-hmm.
This so-called sick out.
Right. And it wasn't always a coordinated protest. You know, sometimes it was just people being genuinely mentally unable to perform a life or death job under that kind of pressure.
Or they physically had to be at that second job.
Exactly. So you end up with fewer people managing the same amount of traffic, and the people who are there are already exhausted.
Which brings us to Secretary Sean Duffy. He wasn't just speculating.
No, he was looking at hard data.
He repeatedly said that the worsening safety data, which we'll get into, was the undeniable reason for the flight cuts. He was basically telling the public, we have reached the point where we cannot guarantee your safety without reducing the volume of planes in the air.
And that is such a critical point. The political fight in Washington created the immediate crisis, but it didn't create the underlying weakness.
It just exposed it.
It exposed a deep, pre-existing vulnerability that had been festering for years.
It's so tempting to just blame the shutdown for all of it, but the FAA itself admitted they were already short thousands of controllers. Doesn't that mean the shutdown was really more of a symptom of a deeper problem, like years of mismanagement in staffing and training?
Absolutely. The shutdown didn't create the shortage. It weaponized it. It turned a chronic problem into an acute crisis. The FAA was already struggling with this massive staffing gap before any of this started.
How big of a gap are we talking about?
The estimates were somewhere between 3,000 and 3,800 controllers short, just to meet their own basic operational targets.
So the system was already stretched thin.
Incredibly thin. For years, it had been running hot. We're talking mandatory overtime, six-day work weeks, controllers being assigned shifts that push them right to their legal hour limits. All of that just compounds fatigue, even in the best of times.
And then when the paycheck stopped, the financial certainty vanished, and the exodus just accelerated.
Dramatically. I think people miss this detail. It wasn't just normal turnover. Toward the end of the shutdown, Secretary Duffy noted they were seeing 15 to 20 controllers retiring.
Daily.
Daily. And it wasn't just the older generation hitting retirement age. We saw younger controllers, the future of the system, just leaving the profession entirely.
They just walked away.
They looked at the stress, the workload, and then saw that their entire financial stability could be wiped out by a political game. And they decided it just wasn't worth it. They went to find something more stable.
It just reveals this profound systemic failure, doesn't it? The whole technological marvel of our air traffic control system is fragile because the human part of it is chronically understaffed, overworked, and vulnerable.
And that fragility is what led directly to the chaos that travelers experienced.
So let's put some hard numbers on that chaos, because for the flying public, it really felt monumental. The data from FlightAware, it just paints a picture of a system failing in real time.
The speed of the deterioration is what's truly startling. If you just take one snapshot, the period between a Sunday and the following Wednesday afternoon, the disruption was staggering.
What are we talking about?
Over 26,000 flight delays and another 7,500 flights just canceled nationwide.
And you have to visualize that. That's not just 7,500 flights. That is hundreds of thousands of people stranded, thousands of tons of cargo not moving. It's logistical gridlock.
And the chaos really peaked on one specific day, November 9th. On that day, cancellations hit nearly 3,000.
3,000 in a single day. What does that mean in context?
It means about 10% of all scheduled U.S. departures for that day were just wiped off the board.
10%. That is a shocking number when you think that on a normal day, the cancellation rate is usually less than 1%.
Exactly. It's a tenfold increase. Now, to be fair, that number was made worse by some severe weather in the Northeast that day.
Sure.
But the system's inability to absorb that weather shock, which it normally does with relative ease, that's the direct result of running on empty from a staffing perspective.
So let's drill down a bit. Which airlines and airports really took the brunt of this?
The pain was pretty widespread, but it wasn't evenly distributed. If you look at the major carriers, Southwest actually logged the highest number of delays, over 9,000 in just that one week.
And that's probably due to their operational model, right? The quick turnarounds. One delay just cascades through their whole system.
That's exactly right. But on the cancellation side, it was Delta that took the biggest hit.
Okay.
They recorded the highest number of outright cancellations, cutting over 1,300 flights.
So you see different strategies. Southwest tries to ride out the delays. Delta just starts canceling to protect the rest of their schedule.
Right. And in this situation, both approaches just led to massive disruption for passengers.
And crucially, this wasn't just a New York or LA problem. The FAA's restrictions were imposed across 40 major airports.
40. That's virtually every critical hub for domestic and global travel.
You're talking about places like Chicago O'Hare.
O'Hare initially led the country in cancellations. Then you have Newark, a key gateway for New York. Hartsfield-Jackson in Atlanta, the world's busiest airport.
And even some you might not think of first.
Right, like Indianapolis International Airport. It actually ended up being a top 10 airport for canceled departures because of these restrictions.
Indianapolis is a really interesting example because it shows how interconnected the whole network is. It's not just about the huge coastal cities.
Precisely. The FAA was managing systemic risk. And even smaller airports that weren't on the list, say the Portland Jetport in Maine, saw huge indirect impacts.
How so?
Nearly 30% of their flights were impacted, either canceled or delayed, because 97% of their flights connect directly to one of those 40 restricted hubs. The network effect was absolute.
Okay, let's get into the technical heart of this. The safety data. Secretary Duffy kept citing troubling safety data. The specific reports weren't really released publicly, but what were officials tracking that showed the system was so close to breaking?
The indicators they were watching were direct, measurable consequences of controller fatigue and understaffing. These were not abstract ideas. There were operational errors happening in real time.
Like what, for example?
Oh, well, the first and most alarming one was an increase in reports of planes getting too close to each other in the air.
A loss of separation.
Exactly. A violation of aircraft separation standards. That is the nightmare scenario for any controller. The legally mandated distance between planes was breached, often because of a delayed reaction or miscommunication from an overworked controller handling too many sectors at once.
What else?
A measurable increase in runway incursions.
So that's when a plane or a vehicle is on the runway when it's not supposed to be.
Right. It could be an aircraft, a baggage cart, a person. It often happens because ground control is understaffed or distracted, leading to a miscommunication with a taxiing plane. It's incredibly dangerous.
And finally, the pilots themselves were raising red flags.
That's right. The FAA was tracking pilot concerns. Pilots were reporting that controllers sounded audibly stressed or fatigued, that communication seemed sluggish or instructions were unclear. The stress was leading directly to operational errors.
And all of this gets boiled down into one critical metric the FAA used, the staffing trigger event. We heard that phrase a lot. What does that actually mean on the floor of a control center?
So a staffing trigger event is a formal metric. It's declared when an air traffic control facility, a tower, or a regional center falls below the predetermined safe staffing level required for the amount of traffic they're handling.
So every facility has a minimum number of bodies they need on every shift to operate safely.
Exactly. And if too many people call out sick or retirements aren't replaced, the facility management is mandated to declare it. It's an official alarm bell.
And when this crisis hit its peak, how bad did that metric get?
It skyrocketed. On November 8th, the number of staffing trigger events hit a record high of 81.
81. Just think about that. 81 separate air traffic control facilities across the country were all, at the same time, operating below the margin they themselves had defined as safe.
That one, number 81, is the data point that drove the FAA to start mandating these increasingly severe flight cuts.
Which really left them with no other choice. They had to intervene
and
aggressively. This leads to that unprecedented response we talked about.
Mandatory flight reductions. An emergency order.
Let's walk through how that escalated starting on November 7th.
The initial order was, you know, relatively moderate, at least compared to what came next. It required all airlines at those 40 busiest airports to cut 4% of their scheduled flights.
And the airlines got to choose which flights to cut, but the total number was mandated.
It was not a suggestion. It was a mandatory safety measure.
But 4% didn't hold for long. Why did it have to escalate so fast?
Because the root cause, the lack of pay, the sick outs, the fatigue, wasn't getting better. The political gridlock was continuing.
So the problem was getting worse.
Exactly. So the FAA quickly moved to a mandatory 6% reduction across those 40 hubs. And what's really telling is that internal documents show they were already planning for worse.
What were those future plans?
They were severe. They were preparing for an 8% cut and then a 10% cut by Friday, November 14th, if the shutdown had continued.
A 10% mandatory cut nationwide. That sounds like the system bracing for an almost total collapse of air travel right before Thanksgiving.
That's what it was. It was triage.
But then, just as they were planning for 10%, the politics shifted. Congress started moving toward a deal.
And this is where you see the stunning immediate link between financial security and system stability. On Wednesday, November 12th, the day the deal was struck, the FAA made the call to freeze the cuts at 6%.
And their reason?
They explicitly cited a rapid decline in controller callouts. The moment the controllers knew they were going to get paid, they started coming back to work. The stress began to ease.
That moment, the passage of the funding bill, was the trigger for the recovery.
Absolutely. The data shows it. The move toward funding instantly began the healing process for the system.
But there's another fascinating part of this. Even with the FAA imposing these mandates, there was a conflict brewing with the airlines over compliance.
Yes, this is a great point. The airlines are commercial businesses. They're trying to protect their schedules, their profits. And they ran right into this federal safety mandate.
What were the reports?
The FAA put out a statement saying they were, and I'm quoting here, aware of reports of noncompliance by carriers during the emergency order.
So in plain English, some airlines were just operating more flights than they were allowed to.
It appears so. Likely hoping to avoid the logistical nightmare of canceling even more flights and maybe hoping no one would notice.
But the FAA noticed. This sounds like a direct challenge to their authority during a safety crisis. What were the consequences?
They were not taking it lightly. They confirmed they were reviewing and assessing enforcement options, and they were very clear about the potential fines.
And the fines were massive.
Oh, yeah. They explicitly mentioned that fines could be up to $75,000.
Per flight.
Per single flight operated above the mandated limit. It's a huge financial deterrent. I mean, run 10 unauthorized flights and you're looking at a $750,000 fine.
So they were using both carrots and sticks. The carrot was the back pay and bonuses for the controllers.
And the stick was the threat of massive fines for the airlines to force compliance. It was a two-pronged approach to stabilize the system.
Let's move to that recovery then. Once the funding was restored, the speed of the return to normal was just astonishing.
It was immediate. The end of the shutdown meant two crucial things for the controllers. First, the promise of back pay. They were assured they'd get 70% of what they were owed within 48 hours.
So immediate cash flow.
Which is huge. And then on top of that, there was a major psychological and financial boost.
The bonuses.
Yes. President Trump recommended that controllers who work through the shutdown get a $10,000 bonus. A similar promise for TSA officers. This wasn't just pocket change. It was a significant recognition of their sacrifice.
And it must have done wonders for morale.
It contributed massively to the high staff return rates and just accelerated the whole stabilization process.
Which allowed the FAA to start rolling back those cuts almost immediately.
The timetable was incredibly compressed. On Friday, November 14th, just 2 days after the shutdown ended, the FAA felt confident enough to cut the mandate in half, from 6% down to 3%.
But the real proof, the metric that showed the system was healthy again, was the drop in those staffing triggers.
This data point is the most powerful part of the whole story. The system just snapped back. Remember that all-time high of 81 triggers?
On November 8th, yeah.
By Friday the 14th, that number had plummeted to just six.
Six. From 81, that's a reduction of more than 90% in operational risk in less than a week.
And it kept dropping. It went to 8 on Saturday, but by Sunday, November 16th, there was only one staffing trigger reported, nationwide.
One. And that's a normal number for a regular day.
That is consistent with pre-shutdown normal operating conditions.
And based on that confidence, the FAA made the call.
They did. On that Sunday, the FAA administrator announced they were rescinding the entire emergency order. They had the confidence that the system was sufficiently staffed to handle full capacity again, safely.
Meaning normal operations could resume.
Starting Monday, November 17th at 6 a.m. Eastern, it was the formal declaration that the safety emergency was over.
And I think it's important to stress, this wasn't just about the big airlines getting their schedules back. This was a broader return to functionality for the entire airspace system.
That's a crucial detail that gets overlooked. Rescinding the order ended restrictions on a whole bunch of other aviation activities.
Like what?
General aviation, for one. So private planes, business jets, flight training schools, all of that was back to normal. Also, they lifted limits on certain visual flight rule, or VFR approaches.
Which are more labor-intensive for controllers, right? Because they have to actively monitor pilots who are flying by sight.
Exactly. When staffing is critical, VFR operations are one of the first things to get restricted because they demand so much controller attention.
So restricting them in the first place was a sign of just how stretched they were.
It was. And lifting those restrictions showed they had the capacity back. The order also ended limits on commercial space launches, parachute operations. It touched every single part of American aviation. This was a full system reboot.
And the timing of this normalization, November 17th, was just absolutely critical. It put the industry back on its feet right before the busiest travel season of the year.
The entire industry was breathing a huge sigh of relief. Thanksgiving travel was set to kick off around the 25th.
So they had about a week to spare.
Exactly. And the airlines were incredibly optimistic. Delta's CEO, Ed Bastian, he came out and predicted a return to normal a lot faster than people think, and he was right.
The data backed that up.
Oh, immediately.
Yeah.
Cancellation rates plummeted back below 1% that weekend, even before the last of the restrictions were officially lifted. The system was showing it could handle the load.
Which was essential. AAA was predicting 6 million Americans would fly for the holiday.
It was fast enough to save Thanksgiving travel.
But even with things looking good, the trade group Airlines for America was trying to manage expectations a little bit.
They wisely warned about residual effects for days. And that's because you can't just slip a switch.
Right. You have thousands of planes and tens of thousands of crew members who are in the wrong places.
Exactly. A plane that was supposed to be in Denver is stuck in Newark. A flight crew's duty clock is maxed out. Rebuilding those schedules and repositioning all those assets is an incredibly complex logistical puzzle that takes days to fully smooth out.
And beyond the logistics, there are the lingering issues with the staff themselves. The funding was back, but the stress didn't just disappear overnight.
That's the deeper, long-term risk. To get through the crisis, controllers and pilots had to maximize their hours. Many pilots were pushed right up against their maximum allowable flight hours. The whole system was running on surge capacity for weeks.
Which means there's no slack in the system?
Almost none. It means the system is still brittle. If a major winter storm had hit in December, for example, those fatigued crews and limited reserve resources could have triggered a whole new wave of delays.
And that brings us right back to the root vulnerability.
Yeah.
The massive, chronic shortage of air traffic controllers. The funding crisis was over, but the staffing crisis was not.
It absolutely was not. And this is the issue that transcends politics. Even with the government fully funded, the FAA is still short those 3,000 to 3,800 controllers they need.
So the focus has to shift to a long-term fix.
It has to. As Secretary Duffy said, the focus now is on surging controller hiring and modernizing the system itself.
But hiring and training a controller? That's not a quick fix. It's a multi-year process.
It's an essential and unavoidable challenge. One expert estimated it could realistically take 2 to 3 years to hire and fully train enough controllers just to close that gap.
2 to 3 years.
So until that happens, the system is going to continue to run with this inherent fragility, relying on the goodwill of an overworked workforce. We remain one major crisis away from a repeat scenario.
And the industry trade groups? They seized this moment of public pain to push for some real structural policy changes.
They pushed hard. Airlines for America, which represents the carriers, urged Congress to fix the FAA's funding structure. Specifically, they want the FAA to be allowed to use its own airport and airway trust fund to pay controllers during a shutdown.
That seems so logical. Why isn't that already the case? The fund is paid for by ticket taxes.
It sounds logical, but legally it's not currently allowed. That $5 billion fund is generated by user fees, ticket taxes, fuel taxes, but legislative rules restrict how it can be used during a funding lapse.
Yeah.
It's usually earmarked for things like capital improvements, not day-to-day payroll.
So the industry's proposal is a surgical fix to take aviation out of the political line of fire.
Precisely. The goal is to decouple this vital infrastructure's payroll from the political budget process. They argue that aviation is essential national infrastructure, and using it as collateral damage in funding fights is just dangerous and irresponsible.
This whole saga really gives you a transparent look into how American infrastructure actually functions. A 43-day shutdown creates a systemic safety crisis, pushing those staffing triggers to a record high of 81.
But the moment the funding bill passed, the moment controllers knew they would be paid, that safety issue essentially vanished. Those 81 safety triggers dropped to just one in a matter of days. Stability was restored almost instantly once the human element was financially secure.
The lesson here is just startlingly clear. The safety and reliability of our entire national airspace system hinge completely on the financial security of a few thousand federal employees. The technology didn't break.
No. The mechanism designed to pay the people operating the technology broke.
And that raises a final and I think profound thought for you to consider.
We saw how quickly the air travel system stabilized once the spotlight hit and the money was restored. But the shutdown didn't fix the underlying problem of chronic understaffing. It just exposed it. We know that ATC shortage persists. So what other unseen critical government function systems vital to our cybersecurity, or the teams inspecting our bridges, or public health monitoring? What other systems remain chronically understaffed, just waiting for the next political or funding shock? Understanding the journey from 81 safety triggers back down to one should encourage all of us to stay informed about these invisible infrastructure vulnerabilities that really determine the safety of our daily lives.